Greetings from the snowy KABU studios, and welcome to Labor Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO, which is you can find at 90.7 in Portland, 91.9 in the beautiful Columbia River Gorge, and 100.7 in the Mid-Willamette Valley. I'm your host, Kevin Card, your friendly neighborhood letter carrier, and tonight we have a great show. I've got two guests here in the KABU air room. Jim Cook is here to foment some egregious dialogue in the history and future of the general strike. You know, I listen to KABU a whole lot, and I hear a lot of people on our call-in programs in the morning saying, we need to have a general strike. So I decided to do a show in which we can talk about the general strike in the history of America, and particularly in the history of the Northwest, and what it takes to pull one off, and do we have enough class consciousness to do it in the future. But before we get to that, I have a very special guest, Jamie Partridge, longtime community activist who has recently returned from the World Social Forum in Venezuela. Hey, Jamie, how are you?
Hey, Kevin.
And I got to tell you guys something. If you were listening to the show prior to us, okay, which was a great show about immigration, which is a huge issue for the working class, not only in our country but in the world, Jamie comes walking in here, and everybody gives him a hug because he knows everybody that has to do with anything in the activist community in Portland. So a round of applause for Jamie here.
But don't leave out that I'm also a friendly neighborhood letter carrier, as is.
That's right. We have an all-letter carrier night tonight. Yeah. Okay, so here's the scoop. First, let's talk with Jamie. Jamie, just like I said, just returned from the World Social Forum in Venezuela, where he was a delegate on behalf of the Portland Jobs for Justice, right, Jamie?
That's right.
And you went down there to kind of take a look around and represent our interests and kind of figure out how Jobs for Justice meshes with this World Social Forum. Maybe you can tell us exactly how this all came about.
Well, the World Social Forum is a gathering of about 60,000 anti-corporate activists from North, Central, South America. Actually, there are three of them going on this year, one in Africa and one in East Asia. But this one was the World Social Forum of the Americas. And there were about 2,000 workshops led by hundreds of different groups over a period of 6 days in Caracas, Venezuela, talking about basically how we create an alternative to the corporate free trade, privatization, corporate domination of the world. And there were a lot of groups from very grassroots neighborhood worker groups all the way up to municipal and national governments. And the really exciting thing about being there was the fact that we were in Venezuela, where a social revolution has been occurring for the last 6-7 years, and we really had a great time checking that out.
Well, let's talk about this revolution. This you brought back with you. I've talked to Jamie prior to this show, and he showed me some really great stuff about the Venezuela Constitution, which is only, what, 1999?
That's 1999,
That's when it was ratified, and it's kind of like every activist dream of what a constitution should be like. And it recognizes some very interesting rights when it comes to labor and it comes to workers in general, right?
That's right. It's probably the most progressive constitution in the world. And it was put together by an elected assembly of people from all different sectors of Venezuelan society and then ratified as a referendum by the whole population. And everybody, or lots of people in Venezuela, carry it around in their pocket. And it's basically the basis of the organizing that's going on there. And people look to their constitution as the rights that they have to, in the way of work, the right and the duty to work, the right to organize unions, the right to strike, the right to directly elect their leaders. And there are also rights in there in terms of people's right to Social Security, people's right to decent wages and working conditions. And there's preference given to people forming cooperatives and people getting the kind of training that they need to live a decent life.
So what did you bring back with you, Jamie? What did you get out of this? How long were you there for again?
There for a couple of weeks. Yeah, I spent a couple of days, about 4 hours each day, speaking with leadership of unions in several different cities in the public sector and the private sector. There's a lot of transnational, multinational corporations there, like Ford, Chrysler, Coca-Cola, Firestone. And I also spent 2 days in the post office talking with all kinds of different workers and union leaders in the post office. And what I found was that these workers have taken advantage of their new rights under the Constitution and have organized to throw out bureaucratic, corrupt leaders in their unions, and have not only improved their wages, hours, and working conditions, but have actually taken some control, and sometimes in some places actual total control of their workplace, and making decisions about what they're going to produce, making decisions about how it's going to be distributed, what they're going to do with the profits, not just for workers, but for the community in which they live. The story in the post office in itself was really fascinating. I mean, a revolution inside the post office just kind of blew my mind. Want to hear about that?
Well, actually, you know, that's you know, I just one thing before I forget about it, I'd like to hear a little bit about this private sector organizing, because you just mentioned a number of these, Fortune 500 companies that actually have factories and whatnot in there.
Mm-hmm.
And how has the new union movement been met by those corporations?
Well, they're certainly resistant to workers taking control of these factories, and especially in terms of raising wages and increasing benefits. But has been happening is there have been a lot of these corporations have attempted to go into bankruptcy or abandon their factories and move in the face of this workers' power, and instead workers have occupied factories and actually kept production going and established markets on their own. And in some cases, they've been able to actually establish contracts with these multinationals and just supply, you know, be the productive facilities for the distribution in the United States. And in other cases, they've turned the production around and supplied Venezuela.
Fascinating. So here's a government that, with its new constitution, is actually trying to take care of itself. Trying to take care of its own people.
Yeah, and there have been a number of attempts to overthrow this new government in the last 7 years, aided and abetted by the U.S. government. And in those, the economy has been destabilized in a lot of these factories. As I said, I think they've identified about 1,000 factories that have gone into bankruptcy or where the owners have split the country, and these factories are being restarted now by the workers, and the government is bringing them into the public sector.
So you saw a lot of hopefulness in what's happening in Venezuela as far as their labor laws are, and do you think that's a model for the rest of the country or the rest of the world?
Oh, yeah, it's a dangerous model for the rest of the world.
And why do you call it a dangerous model?
Well, I'm just quoting Pat Robertson here. No, many of the representatives of the U.S. government, from Condoleezza Rice to Donald Rumsfeld, are labeling Venezuela as a politically destabilizing force in the region, which they are. A lot of poor people and working people, and especially in South America, are looking to this revolution as a model. And leftist leadership has been elected in Argentina, in Brazil, in Bolivia, more recently in Chile. There's a lot of emphasis on cooperation among these countries to the exclusion of the corporations from the north, and that's seen as dangerous.
Dangerous to
by the corporate masters in the north.
No kidding. So what is I think probably cable listeners probably hear a little bit more about the other side of Venezuela, but in the popular press, I think that it doesn't dig very deep to see actually what's going on in Venezuela, to talk about the revolution that's happening there. I mean, you hear more about a estranged middle class than you do about a rising worker class. But you saw that. You saw all of that in action when you were down there.
We spent time. We stayed in one of the poorest communities, the 23 de Enero barrio, and what we saw was the people organized. They lived in impoverished conditions, but a lot of things were changing. There was a lot of housing being built, but the only way that it was being built was because people organized themselves and developed their own plans and presented these to the government, and then they got funding, and people were becoming literate. Adults were learning how to read, and people were completing high school. People were going to university. They're getting the kind of training that they needed to run their workplaces, to establish their own businesses. And health clinics were being established in every poor neighborhood. They have a relationship with Cuba where they're trading low-cost oil. Now, everybody should know that Venezuela is on the map of the both the countries of South America and the Bush administration, because Venezuela has a lot of oil. And they're able to fund a lot of these programs through this oil revenue. And they've got this relationship with Cuba where they've got teachers and doctors from Cuba helping the poor people. They've got 20,000 Cuban doctors in these poor neighborhoods now that have just risen the healthcare standards tremendously for these people in exchange for low-cost oil.
So Venezuela's oil is largely nationalized, right? They own that stuff, right?
Right.
It's their oil.
But before Hugo Chavez, who is the president, was elected in 98, that oil revenue was really going to a very tiny elite within the country. Even though it was nationalized, there was this bureaucracy within the oil company. It was basically siphoning off the funds. It wasn't getting to the people, but now it is. And that's making all the difference.
Awesome. So go ahead. Tell us about the post office, because it sounds pretty fascinating what you saw. I know when Jamie came to our regularly monthly meeting of our local here in Portland and gave us a little presentation, and everybody's jaw dropped. It's a totally different scene down there in Venezuela than it is here in the United States when it comes to the way that part of their economy is driven, right?
Yeah, well, the post office, of course, was a lot more primitive than our post office. There are no machine automated sorting of letters, and the amount of the mail volume was pretty low. They didn't have to deliver a lot of advertising or mostly they're delivering bills. They didn't deliver parcels. But what was really different, they sorted mail and went out on the street and had to avoid traffic and all the things we have to do. What was really different was that before Chavez came in, the post office was rife with corruption. I mean, the top management, including the postmaster, was siphoning off revenues into their own pocket, and the union leadership was on the take too. But after this changeover, the members, the letter carriers, the clerks used their newly won right to strike to force out this corrupt postmaster and to gain an elected position on the board of governors. They want the whole thing. They're trying to get to completely take over the board of governors. Maybe they probably will eventually, but they're basically saying, we know how to organize this thing better than anybody. We do the work. We should be able to run the show. And not only have they been able to better organize their work, but they've been able to bring in a health clinic into the post office. It's an on-site health clinic for them and their families, an on-site child care center for their families. And they've opened up this clinic for members of the community to use, and the classrooms that are in the post office for training postal workers on, you know, the skills that are needed to run the post office. They've also opened up to people in the community for literacy classes, for high school completion classes, so that these folks, undereducated folks, can learn enough to become postal workers. So it's like this whole change has happened within the post office. It's not only benefiting the workers there, but also the community around. And they've also pushed to gain not so much raises in wages. Their wages aren't that high. but they've got a retirement system in place where they get, they're out after 25 years. You know, they can start at age 18 and be retired within 25 years.
Wow.
That's in their 40s at 100% pay.
100%
of what they get as an active postal worker.
Now, is this all subsidized by the oil too? Is everything subsidized by the oil, or is this going to be? It is.
Yeah, it is. This is a public post office. It's not separate like our post office, which just runs on postage. But they've also, you know, they've cut through all the crap about workers' compensation and sick leave and all that we have to struggle with all the time. They have unlimited sick leave. Their social security system picks you up after a while, and it's all 100% of pay when you're out.
Well, I think it's fantastic. One of the things that really struck me when Jamie was showing me some of the articles of the Constitution mm-hmm. of Venezuela was the fact that they recognize women who work at home as being workers, and they recognize that you have the language right there. It's just a couple lines, but it's awesome. Go ahead.
It says, the state guarantees the equality and equitable treatment of men and women in the exercise of the right to work. The state recognizes work at home as an economic activity that creates added value and produces social welfare and wealth. Housewives are entitled to Social Security in accordance with law. And what they mean when they say Social Security is that if there's no income coming into the household and they're raising children, they get Social Security.
So they get a stipend for being at home.
Yeah, basically. And that carries on, you know, into whatever until they're gone.
So what was the attitude of the people there? By the way, if you're just tuned in, you're listening to Labor Radio here on KBOO, and I'm speaking with Jamie Partridge, a fellow letter carrier who went with a delegation from Jobs with Justice to the World Social Forum in Venezuela a couple of weeks ago. And Jamie's just sharing some of the things he found there and kind of, I think, from what I'm hearing, pointing the way towards a hopeful future for at least the people of Venezuela, huh?
Yeah, what I found was that people were engaged. Everybody wanted to talk. It didn't matter, you know. Like these conversations I had with postal workers, I just walked into a post office, you know, and just started talking. And people grabbed me up and, you know, took me away and gave me a tour. And, you know, wherever I went, people wanted to talk about what they were doing because it was like the barriers were being lifted. You know, they did this massive literacy campaign. And UNESCO, the United Nations, has declared Venezuela illiteracy-free.
Wow. Holy mackerel. Well, when a whole population becomes literate, things begin to flourish, right? I mean, people become free thinkers, and there is more access to stuff. One of the interesting things that in Jamie's presentation a couple weeks back was he was showing us the way they sort their mail, and he was talking about how they go into these barrios, into these huge apartment buildings, and tell us about that. They don't have mailboxes, right? Tell us how they deliver the mail.
Right.
This is sweet.
Well, you knock on the door, and or you ask, where do these people live? And if they're not home, you leave the mail with a neighbor, or you leave it with one of the neighborhood organizations. The level of trust and accountability in organization is something that doesn't exist in our neighborhoods. And, you know, in the middle class neighborhoods, they have mailboxes, and it's, you know, but the vehicle that the postal workers use is the motorcycle, because these buildings up in the hills above Caracas are, you know, there's just pathways between these buildings. There's no way you can get a vehicle, a Jeep even up there. And these motorcycles are something else. They drive them on sidewalks. They drive them through the red lights. It's, you know, but it's a different kind of trust relationship. I talk with people who were on these urban land committees, which are neighborhood organizations that decide who needs to have their house renovated or a new house built. First of all, everybody got granted titles to the houses that they had built, that they were squatting on somebody else's land, but, you know, they've been living there for years, and they got granted title to this land. And then these committees say, okay, this family, has many children and is in poor living conditions. They should be the first. And we're gonna organize ourselves. We're gonna put together a plan. We're gonna figure out who's gonna do the labor. We're gonna figure out how to drop the plans for the building, and we're gonna do it ourselves. And then we go to the government and get the money. And in this one neighborhood I was talking to them, they had built 39 new houses in the last year, but they had to do it cooperatively. You know, everybody had to be involved, and they had to decide who got first crack. You know, who were the people that most need. It was it's a very exciting process.
Sounds pretty idyllic. And yeah. So, Jamie, we have to wrap up here.
Yeah.
But people in Portland, okay, all you activists out there, will actually have an opportunity to meet a Venezuelan union leader in the very near future, right?
That's right. One of the leaders that we met from the National Union of Workers, the New Militant Labor Federation, the UNT, his name is Luis Primo, and he's going to be speaking on Sunday, March 19th, 7 p.m. at the Carpenters Union Hall, which is 2215 North Lombard. And if you want to find out more information about the visit of Luis Primo, contact the Portland Central America Solidarity Committee at 503-236-7916. Also, Portland Central America Solidarity Committee is leading another delegation of union activists to Venezuela in November. If you're interested in being part of that, please give them a call. And finally, well, let me just say that for people who want to keep up on what's happening with the Venezuelan Revolution, there's a great website. It's www.VenezuelaAnalysis.com. That's Venezuela Analysis, with the A on Venezuela and the first A on analysis being the same A.
Cool. Cool. It just kind of blends together there.
Yeah.
Well, Jamie, thank you very much for joining us on Labor Radio tonight. I'm sure this is a really exciting subject. Hopefully, we'll be able to, the 20th will be my show, so maybe we can get Louis on here to come into KABU and continue this dialogue, because I think it's, you know, in America, we've had, you know, this year our labor federation split up. There's a lot of disunion in the union movement these days, and it's just fascinating. It's pretty exciting to see that there are possible alternatives out there, but first we have to seize the reins of government, I guess, right?
Right, and I think it's important for us to keep up on what's happening with Venezuela, because it looks like the rhetoric is heating up, and that our government would certainly like to squash or overthrow or strangle this revolutionary movement.
So to build bridges across from the United States union movement to the Venezuelan union movement is pretty essential.
Yes.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll be back in just a minute with Jim Cook to talk about the general strike.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Teamsters Local 206, helping Oregon's working families fight for good jobs and a better future. For information about how the Teamsters can help you win respect at work, the number is 503-251-2344. And also by AFSCME Local 88, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members who work for Multnomah County, Central City Concern, Transition Projects, and American Friends Service Committee. More information at 503-239-9858 or www.local88.ws.
Come on, get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up.
Don't give up the fight. That's right. You are listening to Labor Radio here on KBOO in Portland. And that was just great conversation, Jim, huh, with Jamie? It's pretty
excellent.
Pretty exciting to hear about a country that's, you know, the workers are taking over again. And, you know, that's what the rest of our program is about tonight. It's about workers' empowerment. It's about workers taking over, and it's about some things that happened not only in this country, which we're going to focus on, but around the world when workers have united and decided to withhold their labor. There is probably no greater challenge for organized labor than to go on strike. As we have seen happen in the last few years, we had the grocery workers in California who went on strike and really didn't come out of that battle with what they were after. The transit workers in New York City shut the city down for 3 days this year, trying to foment a strike. It's a very, very difficult thing to do. But we have a history in this country of people banding together. We're going to explore for the next half an hour whether or not, you know, what that whole story is, what the history of the general strike in America is, and also what it would take for to develop some class consciousness to have a general strike in the future. Is it possible? And we're going to entertain your phone calls at 503-231-8187. But first, let me welcome back Jim Cook, who's a fellow letter carrier, longtime union activist, and has taken on labor history as one of his favorite hobbies, that and playing the upright bass guitar. But Jim is on the Labor History Committee of the Northwest Oregon Labor Council. And when I spoke to him, probably about a month ago, about doing a program on the general strike, I think Jim went to the library and checked out half a dozen books, read them all, and probably could fill up the next 3 hours here, but we're going to try to squeeze it in a half an hour. And we're going to do a little intro here, and then we're going to entertain your calls. So you can call us, think about it, formulate a good question. It's 503-231-8187. Jim Cook, what's a general strike?
To define a general strike's important. It's a widespread stoppage of labor by workers in an attempt to bring the economic life of a given area to a more or less complete standstill in order to achieve certain desired objectives. Now, there are three broad types of general strikes: political, economic, and revolutionary, and they can all exist at the same time. What we also have to discuss is the right to strike. I mean, labor in this country is fighting for the right to organize, and the right to strike is fundamental to any labor, whatever, wherever they exist. And the right to strike by a gentleman by the name of L.J. McFarlane defines it this way: whether human rights exist in any country depends not at all on whether its government subscribes to the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, but solely on whether the political system in the country concerned permits and protects the exercise of their rights so universally proclaimed and so extensively trampled on. It is for this reason that the rights of freedom of expression, assembly, and association are such fundamental importance, for unless these exist, there can be no public challenge to government. And governments are most effective in suppressing the rights of political expression and organization where these rights do not exist. Where no right to a strike exists, other human rights, too, will be found to have a mere paper existence. So that's what we're talking about. We have the National Labor Relations Act, but we still fight for the right to organize. And there is what we have to look at is that this struggle has been going on since the beginning of human condition, basically, and as far as there are strikes in ancient Egypt. There have been strikes all through the period of time, but what we're here to talk about pretty much are the strikes in the United States.
And particularly, the Northwest and the West Coast in particular has a rich history of general strikes, right? And this being February, there's an important correlation, right?
Yes, the February 1919 strike in Seattle started with the shipyard workers and spread throughout the city beginning February 6th. And that one, many of us in the Northwest love to highlight because the city was in the control of the workers. I'd like to just give a little bit of the description of the beginning of that strike.
That'd be great.
At 10 o'clock on the morning of February 6, 1919, the city of Seattle was ominously quiet. Some 60,000 organized working men had failed to report to work.
60,000?
60,000. Buses and trolleys remained in their barns. No smoke poured from the chimneys of factories, workshops, or foundries in the ordinarily bustling industrial portions of the city and its waterfront. On that Thursday morning, even the public schools of the Northwest Queen City were closed. Wealthier families had left the city for a haven in Portland hotels. The first major general strike in American history had begun. But now that I've done a fair amount of reading, I know there have been many general strikes in the cities, beginning with our since our American Revolution of 1776.
Yeah, and you so Jimmy, what do you, so this is sweet because you're finding out that the concept of a general strike goes clear back to the just well, after the Revolutionary War or after we declared independence.
Well, when we study the battles that occurred, I mean, first we have to look at the history that we're talking about. I mean, American Indians have to see all of our history as imperialistic,
right,
from the get-go. But once the colonies were here and the fight for so-called freedom existed, the American Revolution was successful because of the unity of workers, and the majority of these were smaller farmers, but there was a concerted effort to beat a common enemy. And from the Revolution, American labor gained some precious experiences. And basically, it was a powerful influence in shaping the ideology of American labor even today because, you know, we think about the ability to have our happiness and life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But as wage slaves and poverty, is pursuit of happiness even possible on a daily basis? So, you know, health is health care is a huge issue for us to get around. But when we go back to the original, the 1776 revolution, basically we learned that the value of collective action and militancy in that revolution. But it wasn't until about, because unions were illegal. They were considered
under the
conspiracy.
British
no, under U.S. after the it wasn't until about the 1840s that they were no longer held under conspiracy acts, but still people organized. And it was in 1828 that mill owners in Paterson, New Jersey, tried to change the dinner hour from 12 to 1, and the operatives, mostly children, conducted their first recorded strike of factory workers in America.
You hear that, kids?
The militia was called out to quell this labor disturbance. And then later on, basically to underscore, and it's important for us to revisit the American Revolution because our values that we, the so-called founding fathers, laid out for us are being trampled upon, our right to freedom of speech, et cetera, right to organize our assembly. We've noticed that in this city whenever we greet the Führer when he comes to town.
Or whenever we have an opportunity to try and have a May Day march or to march through the streets, they want to restrict that freedom of speech.
But for many generations, July 4th was celebrated in much the same way that May 1st has been observed since 1886. And we're going to get to the big 1886 strike here as quickly as we can. But the great, you know, that great revolutionary expression, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, gave the backbone to labor's desire for higher wages, shorter hours, and better working conditions. So, but we have to look that the population doubled between 1820 and 1840. So, and then you had the consolidation of corporations took over the iron industry, you know, steel and coal. And basically, what we have, as I could find, and this is a great reference for folks to write down, History of the Labor Movement in the United States by Philip Fauner is a great, well-documented book. And the first general strike that I found was in Philadelphia, and it was in 1835. And the Irish workers who were unloading the coal, they went out on strike for increased wages and the 10-hour day.
Imagine that, going to strike to only work 10 hours. You know, I was I met a friend recently that I hadn't seen in a number of years, and he started bad-mouthing unions. And I said, well, how many hours do you work at your job every day? And he says, well, you know, 8 hours. Well, thank the union movement. You know, I mean, do you get health care with your job? I sure do. Well, thank the union movement. So the union movement's been active, but Who knew it went back that far?
Oh, and basically a wave of strikes swept the country. And you know why? There was a labor... The news of this got out through labor presses that existed at that time. There were a wave of strikes that went throughout the colonies, even as far as South Carolina.
So, and in other words, the...
Or the 10-hour day.
So the labor movement had their own newspapers.
Well, which they distributed. We'll find that communication through the written word was key to virtually every one success of all of these great efforts.
So Philadelphia, we had our first general strike.
In 1835. And then... There's so much history to cover between now and we're going to jump to 1877. But okay. We're going to jump ahead past the Civil War, 1877, where we had what was known, we were in the middle of a Great Depression, and it was basically dire straits for everyone. The unions couldn't exist really if they didn't have work. I mean, people were out of work. But it ended up that... On July 16, 1877, in a little town of Martinsburg, West Virginia, the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad cut wages 10%. It was a second cut in like 8 months. And a wildcat strike spread throughout the railroad system. And then general strikes and support occurred in many cities, including Buffalo, New York, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Columbus, Ohio, Toledo, Chicago, St. Louis, and even in the South. But the strikers... failed to hold on to it because the law and order was restored by force.
So, in other words, when workers went out, capital, that would be the owning class, had the local militias, the local military on their side.
Well, in that regard, we have Eugene Debs, who was a leader during that period, but also in 1894, Pullman strike. There was a call for a general strike, but the newly formed AFL wasn't very strong, and they weren't going to call out on it for the American Railway Union, which was Debs had founded as an industrial style union. But Debs says, you know, we have only got a limited number of poorly paid men in our organization, and when their income ceases, they are starving. We have no power of the government behind us. We have no recognized influence in society on our side. On the other side, the corporations are in perfect alliance. They have all the things that money can command, and that means a subsidized press that are able to control the newspapers and means of false and public opinion. The clergy almost steadily united in thundering their denunciations, then the courts, then the state militia, then the federal troops. Everything and all things on the side of the corporations. That's what we've faced throughout our history.
Well, you know, and that's what we're facing more and more now, right? I mean, if you take a look at our newest Supreme Court justice, clearly a corporate hack when it comes to deciding very important cases involving working folks. And so we're back where we were, right? We've regressed one more time in the history of this nation.
Some would say we haven't progressed very far. It depends upon our perspective. You know, I mean, basically, if you've got a good paying job, et cetera, we're in pretty good shape. But a lot of people in this country and around the world are in dire straits. And it hurts, you know, to know how much pain exists in the world. And labor being one of the only voices trying to alleviate some of that pain by, in some ways, just getting a decent job for folks and decent wages and benefits. But, you know, we're so poorly... percentage is so low of organized workers, we have to broaden our perspective and build what I believe is and has been built in many times, the solidarity movement, which
right.
is broader
and
than workers.
And a class consciousness. And you are listening to Labor Radio here on KBOO in Portland. And this is your host, Kevin. I'm here with Jim Cook. We're talking about the history and the future of the general strike in America. And if you'd like to join this conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. Tell us, is there class consciousness in America? Could we pull this kind of thing off again? Jim, let's go. You've got some really interesting stuff to talk about when it comes to workers organizing for general strikes and also organizing in the capacity of after the turn of the century, after we fought for that 8-hour day. There was an anti-war movement that came out of the labor movement.
Yeah, people should just check into the library and other sources for books on these subjects, because it is difficult to cover so much of labor history in a short time related to general strikes. But the ILWU Local 5 bookstore there at 10th and Burnside, they
right.
have a labor section that's very good.
Right.
But basically, the autobiography of Mother Jones, because there is her story, labor history, too. And Mother Jones talks about the May 1st in Chicago, because that's where she was at and on May Day.
Is that what turned her into a radical?
Oh,
or
no,
was
she
a radical
became a
that?
Radical. She said in her own words, from 1880 on, I became wholly engrossed in the labor movement. And she says the years preceding 1886 had witnessed strikes of the lake seamen, of dock laborers, and street railway workers. These strikes had been brutally suppressed by policemen's clubs and by hired gunmen. And she talks about the eight-hour movement, which is what May 1st, 1886, strike throughout the country. That was a national general strike. Most industrial cities went out. And what's interesting, though, is that most of these strikes, the leadership tends to not be in strong support of the strike, because they tend to want to, or may, for various reasons, but sometimes it's the noble cause of not wanting to see bloodshed, you know, but, when there is a confrontation of power, because we know what Frederick Douglass said, and if I can just give that quote
go ahead,
one
let's
more
hear
time.
Frederick this, Douglass, yes. Great quote.
If there is no struggle, there is no progress. The struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, or it may be both moral and physical. But it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without demand. It never did. It never will. Find out just what people would quietly submit to, and you have found out the exact measures of injustice and wrong which will be imposed upon them. And these will continue till they are resisted with either words or blows or with both. And you wanted to jump ahead to 1916 when the IWW at their convention, 10th Annual Convention of the Industrial Workers of the World, denounced war in general and stated it hoped to prevent war by proclaiming anti-militarist propaganda in time of peace, thus promoting class solidarity among workers of the entire world, and in the time of war, the general strike in all industries. But
So the IWW at the, in the cusp of World War One.
Well,
right?
At the first convention in 1905, they also endorsed the general strike, and that May 1st become a international holiday. But
so they were looking at taking on the whole war machine in America.
They still do it
almost
today, yeah.
almost 100 years ago, right? And the parallels between then and today are just amazing. Although it's very interesting when you look at when I look at the pictures in the paper of our fallen soldiers, I see the working class. You know, I see working class folks from all over this state, from all over this country, people who you know, many of them who get into the military because of what? Because of lack of better job prospects, right?
Well, again, there's so much rich history on her story to read. This is one from Helen Keller.
Oh, okay.
And this is from Howard Zinn's recent book with on Voices of People's History of the U.S.,
okay.
Just a brief little bit of that. You know, she stated that Congress is not preparing to defend the people of the United States. It is preparing to protect the capital of American speculators and investors in Mexico, South America, China, and the Philippine Islands.
We can just substitute the words, you know, the Saudi Arabia and Kuwait today.
Well,
right?
we're not fighting the Bolsheviks. We're not fighting the communists. We're fighting the terrorists, and that's a war that has no end, and it's their perfect war. But
Helen Keller, how the heck did Helen Keller, here's, you know, we've all heard the Helen Keller story.
It's
amazing.
And her words are so powerful. Here's a speech. She called for a strike, basically, a general strike against the war before the war started, before we entered the war as the U.S. And this is just a little bit of what she said. The future of the world rests in the hands of America. The few who profit from the labor of the masses want to organize the workers into an army which will protect the interests of the capitalists. You are urged to add to the heavy burdens you already bear the burden of a larger army and many additional warships. It is in your power to refuse to carry the artillery and the dreadnoughts and to shake off some of the burdens too, such as the limousines, the steam yachts, and the country estates. You do not need to make a great noise about it. With the silence and dignity of creators, you can end wars and the system of selfishness and exploitation that causes wars. All you need to do to bring this dependence revolution is to straighten up and fold your arms.
Well, that's awesome. Helen Keller, who'd have thought that this was something that she was advocating for?
Yeah, even our fellow worker Joe Hill, has a poem that talking about assassinated by the government in Utah.
Well, Jim, let's talk about the general strike. We've got some of the prehistory of it, and let's talk about the general strike of 1919, here in Seattle, because this is local history that people might understand. What was Seattle like in 1919?
Yeah, we're hoping we'll have some call-in, but we're running out of time, and folks should also check out the history of the San Francisco 1934 general strike.
Okay.
It was dock worker strike that spread along the coast and into Portland, and there's a lot of local history on that. And the Minneapolis strike of 1934, basically called the Teamster Rebellion, and there was a Oakland general strike of 1946. So that is a quick summary. But the Seattle general strike, it started because what we have to look at are none of these things happen automatically. There happened to be many factors lined up to.
There's a precursor. There are things that portend a general strike about to happen.
There have been strikes all during the World War I, despite all the patriotic fervor.
Right. So tell me what happened in Seattle.
Well, the shipyard workers went on strike, and you have to understand the federal government basically funded the shipbuilding during the war, and so the shipyard workers were fairly well paid, but they were offered there was going to be a two-tier system, basically, and they went on strike to prevent a two-tier pay system for unskilled workers. They wanted to skilled workers were going to be paid given a raise, but not the unskilled workers. So they went on strike.
Listen to that. I mean, we face the same thing today. Company is trying to create a two-tier wage system, a two-tier retirement system, a two-tier health care system, and here we're talking about 90 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, basically they had done a lot of public education before the strike in Seattle, but because there had been a rally in January, a big rally, and after the speeches they went through the streets and sang wobbly songs and a parade and so forth, but the military and the police broke it up with their clubs. And then the union newspaper in Seattle had a lot to do with the success, even though if you call it success, it ended in about 6 days. But this union's control of the city. It started out that shipyard workers, but it quickly spread to other workers, including the Teamsters. And before long, all the workers, there were 110 craft unions, all the 110 were out on strike. They were working in concert with the IWW as well.
So there were 60,000 workers. Okay, this is Seattle in 1919. 60,000 workers decided that we're not going to take it. We're going to have one large strike. And how did Capitol respond to that?
Well, basically, they ended up bringing in the militia, once again, the military, and they created something called the Special Police Force. And they had deputized hundreds of people who went around the city, and during the strike, it was very well organized because the unions managed to keep the hospitals working. They had kitchens throughout the city to feed people. They knew that they learned from other general strikes that if the workers were hungry and the families of workers were hungry, they would have to end the strike. But it ended up that it was seen as a revolution, quote, because the AFL in Seattle actually supported the Bolsheviks in Russia and condemned the U.S. government for invading Siberia with an armed force. And so there was documentation that even the conservatives within the AFL in Seattle were more progressive than some of our more radical labor leaders today. So basically, it ended up that the unions ran the city. They had patrols on the city that were unarmed, that only used persuasion to you know, resolve issues. A military leader said it was the quietest he had ever seen a major city in those days. But it ended up that the council voted to end the strike because military was on the edge of the city, and it ended up with bayonets being ending the strike.
So they thought there might be a massacre of some sort. They worried about
They succeeded in showing how workers could control and run a city smoothly, but it ended up with repression. Some of the Seattleites allowed. They had a lot of spying that went on back then, as today, infiltrators, and so there was a lot of repression. The IWW, many IWW went to prison after the Seattle strike. They raided a lot of radicals.
So let me ask you this. We live in an environment today in which capital has totally seized the the high ground, as it's, you know, we might call it the low ground, actually. But we live in a society today in which labor is totally has been diminished by the efforts of capital, right? What do you think, Jim? Do you think that there's any possibility that workers in a city, say, the size of Portland, could band together and successfully pull off something like a general strike over a particular issue?
General strikes are simply a tactic. You know, there are people who know how society should run. It's just we're not in control. A general strike would be a mechanism in a way of achieving certain goals that we have as progressives or radicals. We see society as it could be and should be, and to reach that goal, general strike could be a means, but there are many tactics that can be used: boycotts, slowdowns. The student strikes of 1970, the bombing in Cambodia, led to a lot of college campuses throughout. That was sort of a general strike that swept the country. It was a student strike opposing the war. So their strikes are just a means, but not the end, because so many of these strikes ended in violence, being repressed, the repression increased, but yet they saw the goals out of those general strikes achieved in future years, such as the eight-hour day became a reality by law, not until 1930s, of course.
Unless you're a Walmart worker today. And wouldn't it be great to see all the Walmart workers walk off their job someday on the same day and said, we're not going to take this, okay? We want decent wages and health care and retirement. Do you think that it's possible in this day and age for the labor movement or for progressives themselves to be able to spread the kind of word? Or do you think that the deck stacked against us? I mean, capital owns all the media.
Well, we have the people, but we've had, you know, the people all through the years. We had the numbers. It's a matter of us organizing. KBOO is very unique, and it's, you know, throughout the nation. In a free speech arena, free speech occurs here all the time, but many places people do not get information like this. And so education, agitation, and organizing,
I do think we live in a bubble here in the Northwest. I know, traveling, talking to my friends around the country, nobody has access to the airwaves the way we do on KBOO. Here we have the Portland Alliance, which I think is a great newspaper. We have the Northwest Labor Press, which does a great job of talking about labor issues and about the union movement in Oregon and in the Northwest. It does a lot of exposés on the evils of capital. What would you suggest your average, maybe even your non-union worker out there, do to help improve their lot, Jim?
You know, wherever we're at, we fight the struggle in our own backyard. I mean, if you don't have a union, seek to organize a union. You may be fired, but there are allegedly laws to protect you. I would, you know, basically it's organizing. I mean, we have to educate ourselves first and then organize to the point that we're seeking. And Yeah, the deck stacked against us, and are we willing to sacrifice that which must be sacrificed to reach our goals? Dr. King gave his life for the struggle. Many people have given their lives for the struggle. People, are they willing to give up their job by going on a general strike, one-day general strike for something? That may be the cost.
That would be good. I'm looking forward to that day we have the one-day general strike here in Portland. Jim Cook, thanks for joining us. We could have spoken all night about this, and I'll have you back on Labor Radio, and we'll talk about it. I know you're working on the 2006 May Day Parade. We'll be back on the air about that. That's an annual event.
It's a Monday this year.
It's a Monday. Oh, perfect. That would be a perfect day for a general strike. The Monday, nobody goes back to work. So, Jim, thanks for joining us tonight on Labor Radio.
Thank you, Kevin.
Next week on Labor Radio, Labor Radio host Don McIntosh will be interviewing author Tamara Drought, who is going to be in town tomorrow night to talk about her new book, Strapped, Why America's 20 and 30-somethings Can't Get Ahead. And, boy, is that relevant to you out there and the KBOO listeners? Let me tell you, whenever I run into a young worker in that age group, put it that way, a person in that age group, I ask them, I just have this habit which drives my family crazy. I ask them about their job. Do they like where they work? Do they make enough money to get by? Do they work? Is that their only job? And it never ceases to amaze me how many of these young people are working two or three jobs, none of which give them health care. You know, they scraped by to pay the rent, and yet somehow they remain relatively happy. I'm really impressed with that group. So here's the deal. Tomorrow, February 21st, author Tamara Drought will speak about her new book, Strap, Why America's 20 and 30-somethings Can't Get Ahead. The event is organized by the Bus Project and takes place at 7 p.m. at Acme. I don't know if you've ever been to Acme. It's a neat little club, which is on Southeast 8th and Main in Portland. The author, Tamara Drought, will also be a guest on next Monday's Labor Radio with host Don McIntosh. I want to thank Jim Cook for being here, Jamie Partridge, who came to talk about the great things happening in Venezuela, and, of course, my great engineer in there, Ben, who makes sure that this comes out of the over-the-air waves clean and concise. This is Kevin. I'll see you 1 month from today on Labor Radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from SEIU Local 503 OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day. And also by AFSCME Local 3336, representing the employees of Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality by advocating for working conditions, pay and benefits, supporting political activity that promotes pro-environment and pro-labor positions, strengthening labor coalitions, and actively organizing members. More information at afsme3336.org.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor An Evening in Vietnam, a benefit for Village School Foundation. Experience Vietnamese culture through music and dance featuring nationally known guitarist and storyteller Dinh. Enjoy Vietnamese food and a special video presentation of the Village School Foundation's recent efforts to provide education resources to the children of Vietnam. The event will be held at 6:30 p.m. Saturday, February 25th at the PCC Rock Creek Campus, Building Number 3. For more information, please call 503-957-0740 or 503-997-2260.